What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 57 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, a veteran television producer who has partnered up with my bestie, Melissa Spivey, the Wikipedia of true crime.
I love that. I think I'm going to put that on my business cards.
I think it's perfect. All right, Melissa, today we wrap up our June block entitled Hot Summer, Cold Cases, where we covered some pretty wild stories. Week one, you told us about poor Sarah Yarbrough, the 16-year-old who was murdered literally while attending a school function.
Yeah.
And then in week two, there was that incredible case out of Hawaii, the Nancy Anderson case. Like 50 years it was solved.
50 years, I know, and they caught that guy before he died, and I love it.
Absolutely. Well, and then last week I shared with you the story of Tara Sidorovich out of Florida, and man, that one is just... It was a case that was so near and dear to my heart after covering it on Cold Case Files. And one of the reasons it was so close to me was because of the connections I made. And one of those connections is joining us today. So without further ado, Murder Unscripted is proud to welcome to the show from the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office in sunny Florida. Man, I'm dying for that Florida weather to make its way north.
Yeah, right.
Detective Kurt Mayo.
Happy anniversary. I hear it's your first year anniversary.
It is.
On your success, it seems to be.
Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate
you.
It. It is grueling, man. We grind. I'll tell you that. Like I am a contract worker, so it's like if I'm not on a show, I have more time to work on it. But if I'm on a show and then balancing this on top of it, it's a lot. My Melissa is fortunate enough to have a job where she can put in a couple hours too on it, so we get it done.
A couple more hours than I probably should.
Let's tell the real truth. He was spending most of his time doing the treehouse building.
We don't talk about
Kurt. 100%.
If you out me on here, I swear to God.
He's like, I'm so busy. I'm like watching Netflix. Like what? Building treehouses?
Well, you guys are doing awesome. I've been following you a little bit.
Appreciate that, Kurt. Yeah, thank we've had you. Some really cool guests on. We're trying to cover the gamut. Like we've interviewed some celebs, victims' families, detectives, prosecutor. I mean, we're trying to cover it all.
So it's good work, and it helps. I know it helps the families of the victims. Their cases are getting attention, even if they're resolved. So
absolutely, and that's what it's about, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Well, perfect. Well, this is your first time doing a podcast, right?
It is correct. It is my first time.
It's a little more relaxed. Like you can probably already tell, it's not the stuffy. There's not lights in your face, cameras.
Right. And so my experience with you was during COVID, if you remember. And
I do. Yeah, this is very eerily similar.
Yeah, the same situation because you were on an iPad in front of my face rather than being in person. So
yeah,
I've already done that. So I'm pretty good at that with you, I guess.
Gosh, Melissa, it's wild. Like we actually have the cameraman set up an iPad. I zoom in from my house.
Gosh.
So I'm on this iPad, but my face is like in a chair, like right where I would be if I were there. So it's just like this Max Headroom
That's
bizarre.
That's so weird.
Yeah. It was very weird. It was very weird for sure.
Well, Kurt, we're going to get into a bunch of stuff today, but what I'd like to do is start at the beginning before you were Detective Mayo. You were just Kurt. So correct me if I'm wrong, but you're originally from up north, right? Like not terribly far from us in PA.
I grew up at the South Jersey, halfway between Long Beach Island and Philadelphia. My parents were school teachers, and they were looking for a principal job, so they moved from North Jersey, where they were raised, and to the South and to the farm country to get a brand new school position, and that's where we all grew up as kids.
Super cool.
Wow.
Well, and tell us a little bit about your family. I mean, your grandpa was an immigrant, right?
My mother's father came over to America via Ellis Island from Germany after World War I as a young child. And he met my grandmother, again, my mother's mother. She was working for Red Cross in New York City, and she was from Scotland. And so they got married, and he was a Borden's milk delivery guy.
Oh, wow. And how neat.
He originally had the, I guess, the cart and horse, and eventually he got a truck, and I got a chance to check it out one time when I was very little. And he got me interested in two things in life, driving cars, and he was a huge baseball fan. And so I became a baseball guy, too.
That's really funny. We were going to ask you that a little bit later on about some of the stuff you do in your free time, because I know fast pitch softball, right? You coach.
I coached. I played hardball, and I coached fast pitch for many years. Got a point in my career where I'd been doing undercover work for a long time. It was time. I had my kids were getting older. Daughters were wanting to spend more time and be around some good people instead of all the bad people all the time. So,
of course,
shaved off the beard and cut the long hair, and ended up coaching for years. Put a few kids in college on scholarships, and just had a good time.
Wow! How did you decide to get in law enforcement?
So this is a funny story too. My same grandfather, my mother's side, he decided to retire when I was 5 years old and just starting kindergarten. I told my mother two things. I wanted to just retire. I didn't want to go back to kindergarten. And my other grandfather was a newspaper reporter for a couple of newspapers in North Jersey, and he was a crime reporter. So we would go to his house to visit North Jersey, and he had all the old scanners, and we'd listen to the police calls, and I got interested in that, and I started doing a lot of reading when I was old enough to read, and I told my mother at a pretty young age I wanted to be a detective, and that's pretty much what I always wanted to do. So I guess it was meant to happen.
Wow, pretty cool, because I was wondering if there was anybody, a lot of the detectives we speak with, there were detectives that came before them in their families, either an uncle or a father.
No. My family is all school teachers, and other than, you know, my parents and my sister are school teachers, and my daughter was a school teacher for a while, but most of them were that. So first in law enforcement.
Nice, nice, nice. So I guess it was June 1981, from what I can gather, you end up at the Stafford Township Police Department.
Right.
Right. And you worked there a lot of years. So how did all that come about? How did you land there?
So I had moved from Mount Holly, again, it's about 45 minutes west of Long Beach Island, which is, you know, right on the ocean. I turned 18. I moved out of my parents' house, and I got a place, and I picked up as many jobs as I could, and I kept taking all the police tests, and eventually I got hired at Stafford Township, which is it's the mainland side and the bridge of about 48 square miles going into the entrance of Long Beach Island, kind of like the largest area in the southern Ocean County in that Long Beach Island area. So I spent 5 years as a patrol officer. I really wasn't into patrol, but I knew that I needed the experience. At the time, it was this very seasonal community. So summer season, as you know,
yeah,
everybody goes to the shore in New Jersey in the summertime. And in the wintertime, they would go back home and back to school and back to work. And the place would be kind of a lot quieter. You know, at any given time when I started, there'd be three or four officers for 48 square miles, and you'd be looking for stuff to do. I also started at a time before we had all these rules and regulations. So I worked the whole summer before I even went to the police academy. I was
no kidding.
First day,
wow.
A badge and a gun and a set of car keys. And I just moved
like, good luck.
To the area. And it was 48 square miles. I didn't know the boundaries. I never used the police radio before. I never had driven a police car before.
Wow.
But at the end of the day, I think it's the best way because you got to learn on your feet quick.
That's so true.
It really is. But what? How do you go? This is not like you're going to work at Chick-fil-A or something. Like, how do you go from not being a police officer to now working, seeing incredibly gruesome crime scenes to working complex cases? Like, that's quite a leap without having gone through the academy.
So you learn really fast, especially at on the 8 at night till 8 in the morning shift when there's four people on and you're responsible for an area and you're the young guy, so you're getting all the calls, and that's how you learn real quick. What do I do here? I got to better figure it out and figure it out fast because hesitation kills.
Do you have any cases from like your Stafford Township PD days that really stand out?
My last case before I retired, I spent about 22 years in the detective bureau, which is what my real interest was. I had a double homicide of a 7-year-old and a 14-year-old boy, brothers, who were beaten to death by an illegal Mexican with a ball peen hammer.
Wow.
The mother was Puerto Rican and the father was from Bolivia. And they were a really nice young couple. The 7-year-old boy was had some physical issues, and the 14-year-old boy looked out for him. And at some point in time, the mother and the father, or the mother brought in this Mexican guy who she worked with in the cleaning business and let him live in their house. And at some point, the father suspected something was going on, I think, so they kind of split up. The father left the house. What they didn't know was the Mexican guy had a wife or girlfriend in Mexico who was pregnant, and he was sending her money and needed money. And he ended up tied up the mother in his bedroom. And the two boys came home from school. He took them downstairs, and he beat them to death with a ball-peen hammer.
Oh, my God. And
the mother escaped because he tied her with cable wire, which is not very good to tie someone up with. She hit him over the head with a beer bottle. He eventually put a knife to her, got her in the car and took her to a ATM machine, thinking that he was going to get all this money from the ATM machine, not knowing in American rules you could get $400 a day. And ended up in a high-speed chase on the Garden State Parkway. Early morning hours, the mother bailed out of the car, and he got caught. And he was, I believe he was the last defendant in New Jersey that was indicted for capital murder for the death penalty.
Really?
When in the process of, I had retired and came back, the governor at that time decided to waive and get rid of the death penalty. So he's doing it now, hopefully.
How do you go home after seeing that? It's not like you just clock out at 5 o'clock after seeing the things you see and go home like normal, like anybody else.
It takes a toll on you. I'm a firm believer in, I've been doing this for now, I'm in my 44th year, and I'm a firm believer in, and the family bears the brunt of it. I can tell you that you react in certain ways to things that wear on you. For a year or so, we were chasing around a meth guy when I was doing drug work. And methamphetamines are the dirtiest drug at the time. Back then, everybody involved in it was dirty. There was always little kids in the house running around with diapers, dirty diapers. There'd be spoons and needles all over, blood. The house would be filthy. And we were trying to co-opt people into getting enough evidence to get the main dealer who was driving around supplying all these houses. And one night in our fifth or sixth house, inevitably you do a search warrant on the house and you'd find a pot of spaghetti sauce on the stove that had been sitting there for 4 or 5 days with the sauce running over and dried out and sticky. And the last one, you'll get a chuckle because my wife's sitting off to the side here. I had little kids, and I came home after this last search warrant at night, and I came in, and she had made spaghetti for the kids.
Oh, God, were you just like, no thanks?
Left the pot out, and it was not her fault. I just exploded. My kids are not going to grow up like this, and all I saw was what I've been seeing every day.
Of course.
Yeah.
It just came out, and you know, that's many, many years ago, and we kid about it now, but every once in a while, she reminds me of that, how bad I behaved towards her that day.
So, she's probably a little gun-shy to make spaghetti again.
She's really good, and I love her dearly, and she's put up with a lot of stuff, and so everybody forgets about the families, too, that they suffer a lot. Yeah. So.
Do you ever get burnout? Because, like, after doing true crime, this is now my 23rd year, just writing about these stories, I get incredibly burned out. There's times where a new show approaches me like, hey, and I had just gotten off another one. And I'm like, I'm not feeling it. I can't write about death anymore.
Well, so I got burnout after that double homicide for sure. You know, one of the things that you don't realize is that, like, for me, I had to attend to autopsies. We were working that case. I got called, worked all day, came home, got called out for that. Something was going on at the house. By this time they were in the car and gone, and worked all night till we caught them. Then did the interviews, And then the next morning, I had to travel to the north end of the county to go through 7 hours of autopsies with two young boys. And in the middle of all that, my wife had done a routine blood test, and the doctor had called her and said, you need to get to the hospital right now. Right now, you're low on iron, very low. And So she called, and I ended up finishing autopsies and going to my hospital, and I walked right into the same exact scenario that I'd just been in for 7 hours.
Oh my goodness.
Same kind of bed and the same kind of room with the same kind of lights. And I can't stay here. I'm tired. I haven't slept. I can't stay here. I'm freaking out. And so I get reminded about that too every once in a while. But I'm a firm believer in PTSD or long term. It's, military people get it on the battlefield after several incidents and watching their friends get maimed and killed. But for law enforcement and first responders, when you do it for so long, you see everything, you participate in everything, and after a while it does wear on you. And the reasons why I left there, I retired, I had two more years than I needed to retire, and I just wanted to start new and find something different, and I came to Florida.
It's so crazy you mentioned that, because we were supposed to have a guest on. Her name was Shannon Byers, and she worked in Quinnick County in Georgia, and she was a first responder. She was like a death investigator for the medical examiner's office, and she had a family emergency the night before our interview, so we didn't get to fit her in, but we were going to do a whole episode about first responder trauma and just the things that she had to quit because it was just too much.
Our youngest had graduated from college and had gotten a teacher's job in North Carolina. So we were kind of empty nesters. And there was a lot of stress going on at work. We had a new administration that I tried to work with, but was a little bit not my cup of tea.
I get you.
I was getting stressed out. I could feel myself getting sick. And I literally sat out in our hot tub with a cigar and a De Serona drink. And I looked up to the stars and said, God, I need a sign. Do I stay or do I go? I can't do this anymore. And the next morning, I was called into the new chief's office, and I was reamed out for not backing him in front of the men for a nonsense thing. And I just started laughing, and I walked downstairs, and I packed up all my boxes, and my secretary started crying, and she said, what are you doing? I said, her name was Carol, and I said, Carol, I asked last night, I asked God for a sign, he just gave it to me, and I'm not
there. It was.
And I came to Florida a year later to not get involved in this again.
I understand that.
Well, if we can go back to Jersey for a second, you had mentioned to us that you had a mentor.
Yes, and that's how I ended up in Florida. So when I started out, I was very young. I was newly married with a new family. I wasn't the most young guy growing up. I wasn't the most mature. And I met a guy named Jim Given, who was a police officer in this. He was the head of the detective bureau, which is where I wanted to be. So I interacted with him a lot. He was a South Philly kid. He was kind of a guy that was involved in just about everything that you could be involved in, legal and illegal, as a kid growing up on the streets of South Philly. He ended up going into the Navy, and he was on the one of the last diesel submarines in U.S. Navy, the Torsk. Which is in, I think it's in Baltimore Harbor. It was,
I think you're right.
The museum. He met his wife, and she was a Christian woman, and he got rid of his tattoos, and he stopped drinking, and he started a business together, and he eventually became a police officer in our area. He migrated from Long Beach Island to my township. And so he became my life mentor. As far as being a man, he taught me a lot about police work and investigations. And when I left, he had retired a couple of years before me. And when I had left and retired, he was living in Punta Gorda. So we had friends down here that asked us to come down. It was February. I wanted to get out and just get away from all the stress. And we came to Florida for a trip. And we stopped to see him. And it's 11 o'clock at night. It's the first week of March. I'm in my shorts and my T-shirt, looking at all the fish in the canal. It's like going to go back to the Jersey coast. It was 36 degrees, gray skies for 4 months, 20 mile an hour northeast wind. No, I think not.
So don't remind us. Don't rub it in.
We got here, and then after we found a place, he actually found a place for us, and we moved. And then one night he said, I just had surgery on my knee. I got a take me to this police meeting, this retired officer's meeting. So I took him, I drove him, and there was a new sheriff in town just selected. And he was looking for volunteers, and I'm a union guy, so
yeah, I can
volunteer for anything, you know.
Right, right.
Take someone's overtime pay away from them. But so I was having a beer with a Royal Canadian Mounted Police guy, and we were talking, and next thing I know, the sheriff says he's looking for people with homicide experience. He's starting to form a new cold case homicide unit of retired people. And I feel this presence over my head, and my mentor is pointing his fingers at me behind me. So I thought, well, I don't really know anybody here. At least I could network. So I told the sheriff I would talk to him for a while, and I would help him out best I could. Next thing I know, I'm working.
You're on the team. Wow. Now, I don't know the timeline per se of when these things happened, but at what point you became a certified police instructor in the state of New Jersey in,
correct,
what, 98? So that was before Florida. What does that exactly mean?
So every state has their different rules, but to be a certified instructor, particularly for the state of New Jersey, you basically have to go through a couple classes. You have to take like a public speaking class. You have to prepare a presentation. And then I taught at the police academy. And I taught some in-service stuff. And in order to do that, to meet all the laws and requirements of New Jersey, I think Florida has the same thing, you have to be certified. So you go through the police academy, you go through those courses, you pass them, and you get certified to be an official police instructor. And that's what I did. It doesn't matter. The only specific requirement you had would be for firearms. You had to have a firearms instructor's card, but I didn't do that. I did all the investigating, you know, crimes, search warrant preparation, things of that nature.
It's funny that the person who had no instruction when he joined the force became an instructor.
I think it was the best way to learn, because you had to learn on your feet. And now it's so structured. I mean, these guys go through training for a police academy, and then they train with an officer, and they get signed off. And there's a lot more rules and regulations and liabilities than there ever were when I first started. And things are not as lax as they were back then.
And it's such a different world. I feel like I don't envy anybody who, like, cops right now are under the microscope. And it's because everybody has a cell phone and everybody feels like they're some kind of justice warrior pointing it in their face. I mean, how do you guys even do your job at this point?
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, you have to have a supportive family. And I did. I had a very supportive wife and kids. And I never had an issue in our relationship until the officers in Dallas were killed defending that Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. protest. Yep. And we were scheduled to do a raid on a club that next night. And I woke up in the morning and I was getting my gun on and my badge and all my equipment to get ready to go do that. And that was the first time ever that my wife basically was crying and asking me not to go to work. So it's been different since the couple of administrations ago, where we were loved after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Like the firemen, we were basically, you know, looked at as a good occupation. We used to turn people away. I mean, when I took the test in 1980 or 81, they had two openings. There was 100 candidates. You know. Now they're having trouble.
They can't pay people to come. Yeah.
Yeah. The last 10 years or so, you know, that when we all of a sudden we were, the administration was calling in question police tactics or claiming there was a racial in environment, and it just mm-hmm. made it very bad. So it would be very difficult for me to say to one of my kids, hey, I think you should get into law enforcement right now.
Yeah.
Which is
wild ride.
Switching gears for a second, how did you come to be involved with the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit?
Okay, great question. So when I became a detective, I was interested in narcotic enforcement. That's kind of what I was interested in doing. And I did that for a while. But we were a fairly small agency compared to where I'm at today. We had 5 detectives and a sergeant. So you kind of were involved in everything. And one day I got called by Jimmy Given, our sergeant, and said that a female, a bank manager in town, had been involved or had been making complaints to the FBI that our Stafford Township Police Department wasn't doing our job. And her claim was she was being stalked by someone unknown, and they were sending her threats, and that she had reported it to the police department, and no one was doing anything. And come to find out, it had been assigned to an officer who had his own issues, especially with women. And so they didn't gel together.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, see if you can fix this. Very weird case. Very weird case. Brought her in for an interview to find out what was going on. Sat down, introduced myself. And the first thing she says to me is, I know who you are. I said, well, okay. You know.
Okay, yeah.
And so, I mean, I've been, you know, on the streets for a while. I've been a detective. I said, well, how do you know me? And she says, she started telling me that when I first moved to the area, and I was married before for a very short period of time, that my wife then and I, she remembered her name. She remembered her maiden name. And she remembered when we sat down at her desk to fill out the paperwork for our bank account. And she even remembered my old address.
That is creepy.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Creepy is not the word for it. I felt like I was in like psycho killer kind of status.
Yeah.
The hair on my neck was going, whoa, who does that? You know, like, hey, I remember you from, weren't you a banking customer, but not all that detail.
Yeah.
So I met with her husband. He was a manager for a paint store, kind of Sherwin-Williams kind of store on the island. And he was a little bit more submissive and she was a little more aggressive. And her complaint was, is that she came out of her house one day and there was a pregnancy test kit laying on her front lawn. And then she started receiving mail with block print for her name and the address where they lived. And in the mail were some documents. For example, a card with some statements on it that were not really received well from an anonymous person. It went on and on and on. And at some point in time, she received two different packages. One of them, some of the paperwork she got were the top cover of People magazine. And whoever the person was photographed on the People magazine would have their mouth and their eyes burned out. So it was very weird, and it wasn't your traditional type of investigation. And so, but then she got, and it went on for a while, and it was very difficult because we had a feeling that she was doing it to herself. And we learned that all of her sister had just gotten pregnant. All her best friends had just gotten pregnant. They were all that age. We're all the girls in that same social environment. We're all getting the first babies.
No one was paying attention.
And he catered to her, very submissive to her, towards her. And then she received, two different times, she received a rubber, like a doll. One was like a gremlin, and one was a male dressed in a suit, and both of them had steak knives shoved up in their crotches.
What?
Oh my God.
So at that point I said, this is above my pay grade here. I went back to the FBI who had originally contacted us to say, hey, she's making complaints about you. And said, listen, I need some help here. So they referred me to what was then called the Behavioral Science Unit. The FBI had created a unit based upon their opinion that they could go out and do interviews of serial killers, convicted serial killers, and learn traits and make a science to try to predict patterns, try to predict a suspect based upon the patterns of the crimes, etc. They subsequently learned that it's not a science, it's an analysis. So they later changed the terminology to behavioral analysis.
And that's still what it's called now, I think, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So I was referred to a liaison officer who was a guy by the name of Ray Pierce, who was a homicide detective in New York City, who was one of the first guys to go through the FBI's process. And he was what they would call profiler, but they don't call them profilers anymore, I don't believe. But under the old terminology, that's what they were trying to do, is profile a suspect. And I laid out all the things that he told that were going on, and he said, "I'm going to send you a video. I want you to watch it and call me back." So again, this is the old days. We got the videotape in the mail, and I watched it, and it was an Oprah show, and it was on something very similar where a young girl was stalking herself and sending letters to herself, and it had to do with some relationship issues. So once we learned that, we felt we were on the right tape. But then how do we prove it? How do we
see? You got to prove it, right?
Because it's becoming very irritable for us. We're spending time. So we went to the postal inspectors in Philadelphia. We sat on the post office. We sat on various post office boxes. Again, this is before DNA was well known. Mm-hmm. At the time, we didn't know. We had the stamps. You know, we had DNA then. We could probably pull the stamps and got her DNA. We tried to fingerprint some stuff. We weren't getting anything. And then for a long period of time, we were getting, there were flyers being placed at businesses all over Long Beach Island, and they were typed, and they were all bad-mouthing the manager of the Sherwin-Williams store. And he was committing fraud on the high school by selling them field paint for the football games. And it was crazy. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
We finally figured out that it's her. It had to be her. There's nobody else.
Yeah, who else would it be?
Right? Yeah.
So learned from the husband that she had found out that he had been having an affair with another toy store lady.
I mean, she seems so great. Wow. I can't believe it.
And he was felt that he was being punished for this affair that he had called off. Huh. And that she wasn't pregnant, and I guess the girl had gotten pregnant by her husband, and it was a mess. And if you, I sent you some of that stuff. If you see, I figured Melissa might figure it out.
I sent it to her right away. I was like, this is over my head.
It says stalker the husband, stalker the girlfriend, and all the things that were on the burned out portions of the letter. If you look at the writing on the top of the People magazine, it says, you know, Lorena Bobbitt, you know,
yes,
you know, that kind of thing. So it kind of exposed her.
There were clues in there.
Wow.
Right. So she was a branch manager of a very large branch, and I ended up getting the bank involved in trying to figure it out. And again, this is back in the time when, you know, there weren't a lot of computers. They were not personal computers back in those days for most people. And most people had, and most businesses had, typewriters. And I was just explaining this today to some of the guys in Major Crime Unit who weren't alive back then, that, you know, the automatic typewriters had the ribbons in them, and that the ribbon would automatically move. So you could actually, you can compare the strike on the letter with the machine, and you could also read what was written if you had the tape. You could pull the tapes out.
That's one of my favorite sciences, and it's, you don't see it as much anymore because type. But when I, on my forensic files days, when we were doing those older cases, that was the crazy. I love that you had a record. I mean, just pull it out. Like, there it is.
Well, you'll love this. So, for the one time in my life, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I did a bank burglary.
Wow!
I got one of the vice presidents of the bank, very large bank, you know, all over the place, and we spent a lot of time together, and of course, there's a lot of planning that needs to go into that because she's the branch manager. We had to secure all the video surveillance that goes on all night long. We had to figure out a way to so she couldn't see us go in there. And we went and got an inventory from the bank of all the serial numbers of all the typewriters, and of course, there was one missing.
Wow.
And so we suspected that she had taken it home. And so it just got to the point where it was getting frustrating, and the husband was getting frustrated, and we were consult with Ray Pierce, Detective Pierce, and he said to me one day, he said, Bert, he said, you can't confront her, because if you confront her, the first thing she's going to do is she's going to go kill herself.
Mm.
That's a heavy burden to have because...
Yeah, you're not kidding.
This, and
yeah.
Trying to help here... And he's in a bad situation. And one night he came in and he was, I'm getting a divorce. I'm doing this. And so I sat him down and I said, look, here's what we've been told. And I'm just going to tell you, but please do not do this. And I explained to him, I said, you confront her. They're telling me she's going to commit suicide. And he's promised me he wouldn't do it. And of course, you know how that works. 2 days later, get into a fight. He's had enough. He's passed his limit. And he said to her, Kurt knows you're doing it. They got the evidence that you're doing it. I know you're doing it. You're crazy. And she,
oh my God,
she shut up. She walked into the house bathroom, locked the door, and took all the pills. Didn't die.
Wow.
They saved her, but
thank God. I can't imagine the guilt that you would feel if she did.
Right. Right. I mean, you got to protect those victims too. So if that's a situation. So anyway, through that, years later, the behavior analysis unit changed over, of course, with people. And they do a annual study of cases. They'll do a blind pull of cases that they worked on. And they'll go back and they'll study them and they do a report. And my case got pulled. And so they asked for my help, and I said, sure. And I did a couple other things for them. And then in the Tara case, we had a situation with Phil Barr's living girlfriend, Linda Dilley, who I felt was the traditional methods of interview were never going to work. She hated police. Mm-hmm. She hated us. And we had confronted her in 2012 when we had the case. They had confronted her in 2002. When they were doing the original investigation, and she was a very nasty woman, and the traditional methods weren't going to work. So I reached out to the behavioral analysis unit, group four in Quantico, and I asked for their help, and they decided to do it. And they were a substantial amount of help, but a lot of planning went into it. And that's how I became knowledgeable about them from the very beginning and how I got involved with them.
Wow. And I thought it was cool that they chose two female officers to kind of probably appeal to that, because they were playing like good cop, bad cop, but I guess more nurturing being women.
Well, so what happens when you submit a case like that, and I had a substantial case summary, probably at that time was probably well over 900 pages. And so you submit that with the head of the unit. And then it gets reviewed by psychologists, sociologists, mental health professionals, different people in the professional world. It's the real experts, that kind of stuff. And then they come up with, based on statistics and interviews and experience, they come up with some ideas. And one of their ideas was to have a female detective from our agency and a female investigator from the state attorney's office. And I like that idea, but I said, I don't think that's, I'd rather do someone else. I'd rather do two FBI agents. Mm-hmm. They asked why. And I said, well, because she's already beat us.
Yeah.
And she hates the state attorney's office. She hates the sheriff's department. And it's obvious. I mean, she looks at you and her face gets contorted. She's never going to get past that.
Right.
So, and I also asked that it be held in an independent office because it needed to be out completely outside of that. And I've had that experience before in a murder case where, you take people out of their environment, what they feel that they've beaten you on, and mm-hmm. new environment, they're not as comfortable. And in this case, it worked. It was 3 days of interviews, and they said they wanted to have a Catholic girl, schoolgirl kind of interviewer. And wanted someone more rigid. And so we ended up with two agents. One, Mary Rowan, she's a lovely woman. She's very soft-spoken. She was a fraud involved in white-collar crime. She wasn't a hardcore street person. And she was Catholic, and she went to Catholic school her whole life. So she fit perfectly. Very caring, gentle person. And Lynn Billings, who was the evidence recovery team here in Tampa, which is our area, and I had worked with her before on a missing person case, a cold case, no body case, and she looks like a police officer. She a little bit more rigid, more straight, and the combination worked very well.
Very good. Well, you segued really nicely into Tara's case because I covered that in depth last week, and I definitely want to get some of your input on this. But before we get into that, why is it so important for cold case unit to exist? Why is it so important to keep the word out on these cases 40, 50, 60 years old?
Well, so when I came here, I never worked on someone else's case before. So this was a whole unique environment. I had my own cases, and there was a lot of adjustment to be made. But one of the things that the sheriff at the time, Bill Cameron at the time, and now our current sheriff, who was part of that process then also, the agencies have problems with unsolved cases because if they're not solved within a period of time, or the evidence just doesn't appear, or there's nowhere to go, they're assigned to someone who's working in, say, example, the major crime unit. They're assigned to a detective or investigator. But they might have 40 other cases that are coming in and out the door every day. And so they have a fresh homicide. They don't have time to go go back to the case that's sitting there that there's no evidence on, or there's no leads on, or there's nothing really that they can work on. So they eventually get put in a box and they get put in a records room or a storage room somewhere. And if something comes in, they'll find out who's the assigned detective and they'll call them up and say, hey, we just got this lead, go run with it. And they'll run with it until they get called out on another hot case, and it kind of just falls between the cracks. Well, it's not fair to the victims.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair to their families. And it's certainly not fair to the community because, you know, like in the Tara case, the community got heavily involved in that case. She was missing for 9.5 months. People were out looking for her. People were posting posters all over in the stores. The news people were on it. Everybody was wanting to know, and people were being interviewed. People were being trying to help, and the community deserves an answer too. And at the same token, the community deserves to have an agency that is actually trying to solve the cases. And I think most agencies want to, but there's always budget problems, manpower problems, logistics. And, you know, it gets to a point where if there's nothing to work on that they can't resolve it quickly, then, you know, we have other things we have to work on. And that's what happens. They fall through the cracks.
Well, and I feel like that's the, so if from a television standpoint, that's the real answer. From where you're coming from, the real answer is we're overworked. We don't have enough people to really dedicate to this. And then when we get a case that was cold for a lot of years, our job is to like, what do we fill in the television show in those years? And so it's a constant struggle. And that's why we're like prying at you guys to be like, did you run down any leads? Was there any like little tiny loop that you tried to close or like anything to kind of keep the audience interested in those years where we know what's going on, but the audience, you have to think the audience wants to think that there's something going on behind the scenes.
Right. And so I learned that through participating in several of these TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in a Dateline show that was quite extensive. We had become very friendly with the producer at the time who was here for both trials. Actually sat with my wife in the court every day. And she wanted to go through all that because it was quite a history. But
mm-hmm.
you know, they have a compartment and each show has their own thing and they do it a certain way. And
yeah.
It's not who done it per se for and the period of time you need to fill in and what was done. And it's not as easy as the crime shows are on TV, that you know, you get the special machine, you get the fingerprint, it tells everybody where you live, who you are, where you work, who your neighbors are, and an hour later it's solved.
Spits it right out, yeah.
Yeah, they're always solved in what, 48 minutes or something?
Yeah, the commercial's out, yeah.
48 hours.
Exactly. So I have a question, and you kind of mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but how does investigating a cold case differ from working an active one? Like, what are the inherent challenges?
Here, when we came into here, of course, we had one of our partners was a retired major who spent most of his career in investigations here. So he was familiar with the system. But my other partner was a retired federal agent. And he was not from here, just like me.
Mike Vogel.
Yeah, Mike Vogel. And I think kind of hit on the head is you want a fresh eyes concept. And we teach that now. People not from here haven't had any bias, not intentional bias, but bias because that they've been around it. These are the suspects. We don't have the evidence and move on. And so it gets a little complicated and it's hard to fill that in. But when we came here, you also had to deal with people in the major crime unit that had worked this case that are still working here. I have certain ways of doing things and these guys have certain ways of doing things and might be the same. You got to be careful that you're not criticizing their work.
Right. Because there's egos involved, right? I mean, you want to think there's not because everybody at the end of the day had the same goal, like solve these cases for the families. But
right.
It's not the reality.
Right. And it's very easy to say, what did you do? And then all of a sudden realize,
oops,
yeah. Monday morning quarterback and I wasn't here back then. I don't know what the other pressures were going on.
Right.
So it's something that you have to fight off and, it's gotten better because we've been successful. And so now people come to us with their questions to try to help them. So the relationship has changed and the people change. They move in and out. So a lot of those guys are long retired now. So we're not bruising egos as easily.
Sure.
Because they worked hard and they wanted to solve it just as much as we did.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
Well, and you had touched on this a second ago. When you got Tara's case, one of the first things you did was take these volumes and volumes and volumes of case materials, what was something like 40,000 pages of stuff, and compile it into a kind of a comprehensive, easy to follow document. And that's what you had provided us. I'm sure you provided Dateline and anybody who wants to look at the case, but it really is an interesting breakdown because it includes the past and also the present, like your thoughts almost in real time. Like as this is happening, it's picking out things from later in the case and putting it where they kind of, you're like debunking things.
Right. So when we came in here, we weren't sure what to do. There was no procedure. There was no general method of doing it. This was all brand new. There had been guys that had been assigned cold cases, but the regular detectives, and they were a cold case unit per se, but they also were spent regular cases. So there was no set unit. They were just following whatever the norm was. And part of problems with cold cases is reporting. You know, this agency alone, since the Tarrant cases, had four different reporting systems.
Wow.
So if someone works on it in the initial, like, for example, the one case with Sharon Gill, the preacher's wife, mm-hmm. I believe that was 1990.
That was 90, yep.
Yep. She, the reporting system in 1990, they were still doing handwritten reports. And then they migrated over to a computer system, and then they went to a second software system, and now we're in a third or fourth software system. They're all different. And they do try to migrate some of that over, but it doesn't all come over.
It doesn't always work.
Oh.
You got into a situation where it's like, okay, well, we want to, I thought, I don't know if I can solve this case, but I want to bring it up to where we should be. So that if someone comes after me, they don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so we became librarians. We were trying to be organized and come up with a roadmap. And I work start to beginning because that's the way my brain works. I can't do things in jumble. I'm kind of too compartmentalized.
I'm like that too. Yeah.
And so I figured the best thing to do would be find a system that we could do that didn't everyone could use, which is Word.
Yes. And that's not going away. I feel like they may develop more programs, but Word, I feel like, is pretty stable.
Right. And PDF and hyperlink the files in the document and do a running summary. And that's what we did. And we found out that by doing that, it forces you to read everything and understand it. And it also raises questions because, like you said, certain things come in that may be related that you don't know until years later. And if you go back and search that what you've already done and, there's a link. Well, that raises more questions. And it kind of like I kind of equate that to like planting a seed in a flower pot and putting a little water on it. And all of a sudden you've got a tree and it's taking you in all kinds of different directions. And eventually hopefully you're going to get your answer and resolve your case. So, but originally, and kind of going back to you, Melissa, was we weren't sure what to do. And so we kind of just did this on our own and developed our own program. And I always I would try to do it so that someone coming behind us wouldn't have to redo it. They could pick up where we left off. So
something that had been on my mind since the cold case files days, but the when you're on those shows, it's so frantic and you barely have time to think, let alone talk up on the side. But the very front page of that document that you compiled is a picture, this beautiful picture of Tara standing by a tree along with a Bible verse and a quote. It says, "Thou shalt not murder," Exodus 20:13. And then the quote is, "If tears could build a stairway and memories a lane, I'd walk right up to heaven and bring you home again." And I guess that was in underneath it says it was engraved on a stone that was at the spot where Tara was found in the woods. So I guess what was that a motivational thing for you guys? Like, this is who we're talking about here. And it's like a way to bring her to life and motivate you guys to drive you to solve this case.
So yeah, there's two parts to that. First part is that I have been very victim friendly my whole career. I've gotten into a lot of, I'm a Jersey kid, I speak my mind. I've gotten into a lot of interactions with other people of authority figures that may not see it my way. And I'm always looking out for the victim or the victim's family. And I always try to put what I call face on the case. So, you know, we're all in this bureaucracy and numbers, case numbers, and prosecutors and other agencies and even chain of command. We're numbers. We have case numbers. We have this, we haven't individualized it. So when I started doing the summaries, I decided that if someone's going to read this down the road, they're going to see my victim first.
Mm-hmm.
This is terrible. This is Tara. This is who we're talking about. We're not talking about case number XYZ123. We're talking about Tara. And then I try to put some kind of personalization in there. And in the Tara case, where she was found, the family, her mom, was, of course, very upset after 9.5 months of missing her child, finding less than half of her bones. Put a marker out there. It was a cross and a couple other things, and she had that engraved stone. And I thought that personalizes it because it puts where she was left. And for me, pictures and visual reminders, because, you know, we all get up in the morning and some days are better than others. We got family stuff going on, we got financial stuff going on, bills to pay, pressures going on, and you come to work and you're like, your mind is in 50 million places. And you probably can't see it behind me because of the camera angle, but her picture and a couple of the other ones are up, the big, big poster pictures. And I always put that up there and come in and you look at that picture and you say, Tara says to me or to our guys, hey, get your butt in gear. You know, you got a case to solve and get your focus. So that's kind of what the motivation is. I don't know if it makes it, it helped me and it helps my guys. They're used to it, used to my, so. But just a reminder that who we're working for the families. And when, you know, like I said, I never really did this before. And when we first met Tara's mother, she was in the Eastern Shore of Maryland. That's where she was living. And it was October 1st of 2010 when we got the case. And we're sitting around our conference room Mike Bogle had read the case before, and I had read a little bit of it, but I didn't have all of it. But I knew that I felt like we could solve it. And Mike Andy called her and started talking on the conference call and said, hey, we're signed the case, and we're a new cold case unit, and we're going to work really hard on it, and there's no guarantees. And I'm just thinking, like, if I was the victim here, I wouldn't believe a word we're saying, because she's heard this 500 times.
Sure.
And I wouldn't believe a word of it. So when it came to my turn, I said, hey, Sharon, my name is Kurt Matlin. Gave her a little background to me, and I said, I'm just going to tell you, we're going to treat Tara like she was our daughter. And this case is going to end on our watch. And I got some not so good looks from the bureaucrats here, but I just couldn't take it anymore. Like, it was just like, that's just was wrong. And you know, should I have said that? Probably not, because I kind of guaranteed a result.
Right.
At the end of the day, I felt confident, and we just had to put the work in, and that's what happened.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can imagine that after all those years of just hearing, like, we're working on it, we're working on it, we're working on it. Like, it's got to be falling on deaf ears.
So one of the positive things that has come out of that for Sharon is that she did a video for me when I teach across the country for the FBI and the International Homicide Investigative Association. She is the video at the end. And when you say, as a producer or a writer, that you know, you feel like you're telling these stories, but you're not providing any help, that's not necessarily true. Because what she will tell you, and I've spent many hours with her over the years, been a mentor to her and a counselor and a whipping post and everything else during the trial. But what she say to you is that I want my daughter's story to be told. If it stops one other child or family from having to go through this, I want my story to be told. And she actually thanks all the people that come to my seminars or my courses.
Wow.
At the end in the video with, hey, you know, I just want to thank you. I know you're going to make a difference. So telling the story and telling it honestly, like you guys do, and some of you do, not everybody does, but
mine.
And ethically is very important to a lot of the victims' families. So you are contributing in some little way.
Well, that's good to hear. And we did, because last week it's like I got to say things that we couldn't on TV, because when you're so locked into that, those time constraints and the how long your acts have to be, and like you have to look for certain things to tease the viewer with, where it's like, man, I just want to tell the story of how it happened.
Yeah, I mean, you're stuck with the time constraints, and that's a problem. We had that in the Dateline show. That's a 2-hour show, but it didn't fit. It wasn't so much a whodunit. It was how are we going to prove it.
And exactly.
So, and they automatically go, well, it's an hour show. So it's just you do contribute because, like I said, Sharon wants people to know, and she's not the only one I've heard that from.
No, I had reached out to her too before that, just to, I got her blessing before doing all of this, like to her story last, Tara's stories last week, and then your interview today. I was like, as long as you're cool with this. And she was like, oh my gosh, tell Tara's story.
So we have a rule in our unit that we will not participate in anything unless the family agrees to it.
Good.
Oh, wow.
That's the, we made that rule. Nobody gave it to us from our office. We did, the three of us just decided that too. If you're not good with it, and it, like when we have our media events or we have a, we make media releases, we, of course, we keep the families, you know, on our ongoing cases, we keep the families updated. And a lot of times reporters will ask, well, I want to talk to the daughter. I want to talk to her, say, well, we'll give them your information.
Yeah. You coordinate. Yeah.
To them.
Right. So, wow. Well, the perpetrators in this case were something else. Right, Melissa?
Oh, yeah, Barr and McManus or whatever their names were and their supporting cast. It's like, it's surprising how they acted throughout the investigation, but I imagine they had to be hopefully living in fear all those years because they were already on probation, like for most of their life.
So the number one rule here is don't do drugs. They were crackheads and they had been on a crack binge for 2 weeks and they ran out of money and Barr owned a company. And unfortunately, October, it was the kind of the end of rainy season here. And it, where Tara lived was a low-lying neighborhood. And all the systems, the septic systems were overflowed. And all the houses were having problems. And Barr's company got called to do a survey just to see, to give an estimate to repair the field. And they showed up. And here's this young girl. And all heck broke loose. So.
And that's, I was going to ask you about that because this is something we didn't get to talk about. Like, do you think that they were there? They had obviously done this before with just some of McManus's statements about, I always do that. I walk around, I'm always looking around for stuff. It's like they'd steal from job sites. But do you think that's what was the original intent? And then they didn't expect a pretty young girl to be there. And then that's kind of what precipitated all the really bad things that happened.
So it's kind of a guess, but, of course, neither one of them have been cooperative, obviously. I'm hoping someday that we'll get a straight answer out of one of them. But what I think happened is, or my best guess is that Phil, who got the request from the landlord, didn't realize that the landlord didn't live in the house. So when he went to the house, as you would sell your business, you knock on the door, and Tara answered the door. And then they realized that Tara was a young girl, a pretty good looking girl. And then somewhere along the line, they took advantage of her. I think had they known it was a tenant's house and not who called, they probably might not have knocked on the door because he didn't realize that the landlord lived across the street.
Wow. Well, Phil Barr wasn't just a criminal. He was also a poet. Wasn't he?
Well, so, you know, I said that to you because it was kind of, you know, in Florida here, when you charge someone with murder, they have what's called criminal depositions here in Florida. In the Northeast, you have civil depositions. If you're sued, you have to go and you sworn statement or whatever. The lawyers all have to get a time. Well, they have to do that here in Florida for criminal trials too. And a lot of states don't do that because it takes forever. So it can be 4 years from the time you're charged with a murder before you go to trial, or sometimes even longer.
I thought right to a speedy trial is...
Yeah, it's crazy to me because in New Jersey, if you had a guy in prison or jail for a year, the judge would be having the process.
Oh, absolutely.
So, but it's a different system down here in the South, and so you adapt. But the good thing is that you get a lot of communications, you get a lot of surveillance, you get a lot of intelligence, and you've got time to work things out. So what we had when we charged them, indicted them, was only half of what we ended up getting on them because we had all this added information. So when Phil Barr, we originally got the indictment, we knew where David McManus was. He was living in Western Maryland. And so we had, the day that the indictment was handed over to the court, Mike Vogel and I and one of the state investigators had pre-planned this with authorities in Western Maryland, and we had him locked up right then and there. But Phil Barr was on the run.
Yeah. He changed his name, too, right? He
Yeah, he was a con man, and that's what kind of why I sent that to you. He was a con man. He got in trouble for his business, for stealing money from people in his business and contract stuff and not having permits. And he was just a con man. He was a jeweler. He was an expert jeweler. He bought and sold jewelry. He was just a con man. And a lot of these guys are con men. They've got themselves conned. So anyway, he was living. We had the U.S. Marshals Task Force hooked up, and they found him in Hardwick, Vermont, which is pretty close to the Canadian border. I had a feeling he was in the Northeast because he was originally from New York. And in a lot of our intelligence databases, the Northeast doesn't sell their information to the private companies. So there wasn't a lot of information after he left Florida, Virginia area.
Okay. I
felt like he was in New York or in that area because we lost contact with him on bank accounts or phone numbers or addresses or driver's licenses or anything like that. And so the regional task force found him, and a couple of ATF guys, marshals and FBI went to his house, and he was living with this woman named Jean. And she had several older children and a younger boy, I believe. And he was living with her, and he was being a con man to her. He was using her for his benefit, which is what he did.
That's what he did, right?
Yeah.
And so when he was arrested, he was brought back to Florida, and he was put in our jail. So we got to be able to monitor his communications. And we conducted an interview with her. And of course, she wants to believe him. And she's a little naive. She's not. She didn't have a lot of worldly experience, and so she was taking his word for everything he was telling her. And that
she sounds like a good person. Like that's what good people do, is they trust.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Very naive to the reality of the world. And a guy like him. At one point in time, when he was up in that way before he met her, he was in a hotel. He was using, I forget the name now, you might remember, he was using the name of one of the personalities on TMZ to check in and out of the hotel.
Oh, my gosh.
Who's the TMZ guy, Melissa?
Harvey
Levin? Or
yeah.
One of the guys, he was using their name. He was doing some kind of scam where he was selling online pharmaceuticals from Canada. He had met some other woman. Mike Vogel and I went up to interview people just to see what we could get in the footprint up there after he was arrested. And he had met some other woman up there who was married, and he kind of got into her with a little bit against her husband's knowledge. And this woman had let him use her car and let him use her GPS. And when we downloaded the GPS, he'd been stealing. He manufactured ATM cards and IDs, and he was going to ATM machines all over the New England area and cashing out stuff. And we tracked him with that. And so he was up there, and he was abusing her. But she had all of his assets.
Oh,
she was taken out of the house.
Okay.
So, and the other thing is that he was a convicted felon, and he had firearms in her house.
That's a no-no.
We went to the U.S. attorney up there, made a face to the case. At the time, we weren't 100% sure we were going to be successful with Barr, and we wanted to make sure that he got convicted of something. So we talked to this the U.S. attorney, the criminal chief, and the ATF and FBI in the same room, and took that picture and sat down with them and said, "This is Tara, and this is her story," and made it personal. And they ended up indicting him for the guns, which is rare because he was facing a life without parole here.
Wow.
But anyway, while we're monitoring him, we're listening to a jail call one day, and he says, "Oh, Gene." And the reason why these guys keep these women on the hook is because they want commissary paid for
them. Of course, they need they need something.
Food. They need someone to send them money. So they keep, and this is not uncommon. We're going through this right now with someone else. Got four or five women that he's in love with that don't know about the other four or five women.
Kurt, I ask you not to talk about that, please.
Yeah. He's trying to keep her on his side. So he's telling her he's in love with her. He's He's infatuated with her. They're going to be together for the rest of their life as soon as he beats this criminal charge. It's nonsense. And he tells her, hey, I wrote you a poem. And he proceeds to, I gotta put this up here because.
Can you read it to us?
Okay, so this is the jail conversation that he says. He says to her, you got a second? You want to hear something that I made you? And she says, okay, yeah. He says, all right, hold on. Let me get where I can read. All right, are you ready? And she says, yes, I'm ready. Now he's got her all set up. He says, all right, I thought of you with love today, but that is nothing new. I thought about you yesterday and days before that too. I think of you in silence. I often speak your name. All I have are memories and your picture in a frame. Your memory is my keepsake, which I'll never part. Until I can hold you in my arms, I hold you in my heart. And she responds and says, oh, very pretty. And of course, that's just melting her heart because her man has been unlawfully arrested and transported to Florida.
Oh, my God.
So later in the same conversation, he's telling her that his lawyer that he hired was in the paper today, where a guy had shot through someone's windshield and his lawyer got the charges dropped because the guy changed his story, the victim changed his story or something. And he's trying to impress upon her that he's got the best lawyer and he's getting out. He's trying to reinforce that with her. So now we can monitor these and conversations, and we can do that on our laptops. And Mike Vogel apparently had his at home and he was in his living room. And this is not a 9-to-5 job. So, you know, when you have nothing to do and you have an active prosecution going on, you're working it on your spare time at home. And he started listening to the jail call and listening to this poem. And his wife says, wait a minute, I just read that somewhere.
Oh, he didn't even write it?
The actual newspaper. So she finds the newspaper, the local newspaper.
Oh my gosh.
And that poem came from a U.S. Navy retired officer who had just passed away. It was in the obituary section, and it was his wife had written this with his photograph.
Oh, man.
It was this poem that she wrote to him. The difference was at the end, because he's dead, the poem actually says, God has you in his keeping. I have you in my heart. Well, Phil's not dead, so he had to change the last line. Until I hold you in my arms, I hold you in my heart.
Yeah, and change the tense.
It's hysterical.
Wow.
So I documented that whole thing because I wanted someone to know that that's like the mindset of a con man.
That's him. That's what he does. And the irony of that is, like, I feel like if he would have put all the effort that he put into being a con man and pulling all this shit, he could have put into being a good septic. Like, they make good money. Run your business, man. Run it. Like he would have had it such a better, like, it's just such a waste of life and terror, man.
So, interesting story. The special agent in charge of the BAU-4 unit that I originally contacted and I sent my original case summary to had just bought a new house and moved his wife to Pennsylvania, somewhere close to where you could get to D.C. when you had to. And he freaked out. He goes, you know, I never thought about that, having these workers come to my house when I'm not here and letting them in the house. And my wife is here alone. He said, I've changed all my rules. It's not going to happen because of that case.
Wow. I said it reminded me of the BTK case because he worked for whatever the alarm company is. So, like, right. He was going into people's houses. That's so creepy.
And the thing was, I mean, I found a company that Phil Barr had worked for prior to where he got his experience in the septic company. And I talked to the owner, documented, as a septic worker, do you go in someone's house? And the answer is no, because a septic license is only for outside the house.
Oh, so the toilet thing, did he make that up or did they actually have a problem with their toilet?
No. So what we're thinking is that the reason why Sharon had called the landlord was because the house was having a smell in the septic system. If you ever had one, which I had in New Jersey.
Melissa did. Yeah.
Yeah. And
when the septic tank is overflowing, you start getting a smell through the bathroom and it comes in the house. So, and they were very naive when they had come from Scranton, PA. They had just moved there and they had never had a septic system before, so they didn't know, and I'm sure Tara didn't know. And she was probably complaining, hey, the toilet's backed up and the shower's backed up, and they'll use that to get in the house and say, show me. And David comes behind and starts stealing.
Unreal. Is Tara's the case? We're going to wrap up here, but is Tara's the case that kind of sticks out with you the most? Like, is it the most memorable of your career so far? Just because of the amount of work that went into it and the fact that you were able to bring justice to this family after all these years.
I think it was probably one of the most complicated cases I worked on. I've had a few memorable cases which could last hours of talking, but I've spent probably more time with learning about victims with Sharon and her family in the Tara case and appreciate what we all can do for them or how we handle them. For example, Sharon, of course, would get very emotional. It's her daughter, and she never grieved. She's 9.5 months of missing her daughter, so she's fighting to find her. And then 10 years or so, or 12 years, or 13 years to find out who did it. And then the rest of the time to get them convicted. And the day after the second trial, when McManus was convicted, I said to her, I go, you know, this is really weird, but you never grieved. You're going to go through the hardest time of your life right now because it's over. There's nothing left to fight.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I said, you need to get some counseling. And she did. And it took a year. But during the trials, like, I used to have to tell her, you know, don't scream at the prosecutor when something's not going your way. Don't, you know, you have a problem. Take me outside. Punch me. Don't punch anybody else. Yes. She did one time. I said, it's fine to do it because it's for the good of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And she's been really good. But like I said, she really appreciates that her story's being told. And every time we do something like this or a presentation, I just got done Grand Prairie, Texas, a couple weeks ago.
I saw on Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, and I tell her, I said, hey, we got some more people that know your story. And she's just ecstatic about that.
That's got to be the best thing that could come out of this tragedy.
I got one more thing for you, if you got time.
Always, yep.
Yeah.
So about a year or so ago, Sharon had come to the point where she called me and said, she's from Pennsylvania, and she said, I'm ready to put her ashes to sea.
Wow.
Oh.
And I said, okay. She said, do you think if I come down there that you can get me out in a boat and we can put her out? And I said,
no question.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
So what something that I did not know was one of Tara's favorite animals was a dolphin.
No, I didn't know that.
And so the day that they came down, it was Sharon, her Tara's grandma, her sister, and a friend. And I took my wife and I, we went out in the boat, we picked them up at the dock, and we started heading towards the Gulf. We're in a big harbor here. We have to get out the harbor and through the pass and into the Gulf. And she wanted to be off Boca Grande, and which is a lighthouse there. It's a reference point. And when we left the dock, we got out into the harbor, and all of a sudden, there's two dolphins next to us. And these two dolphins, I'm going to get emotional about this, but these two dolphins followed us all the way.
Shut up.
Oh, my goodness.
45-minute ride to the harbor. Or to the pass. We get to the pass, and it's kind of a shallow area. And she wanted where she wanted to drop it. Oh, and she had a very heavy canister, metal canister, with two dolphins, figurines on top. Very ornate.
That's so cool.
And so I said, okay, I'm a little leery about putting it here because this is a shallow area, and someone may drag it up. They do a lot of fishing here, tarpon fishing. Someone might drag it up. And I think if you go out in the channel where it's real deep water and between the channel markers, we can put it there. And then you can sit on the beach by the lighthouse and know exactly where she is. And she thought that was a good idea.
How so freaking cool. We
pulled there from there up to the channel markers. And we stopped the boat. The two dolphins start diving in the air, crossing the front of the boat.
Wow.
God, like how perfect.
my wife and I sat back, and they went off to the side, and they were as a family, and then they went to put her in. And the dolphins both came up after they dropped it, flipped their tails, and that was the last we saw them. Amazing.
That's amazing.
I would ever believe that story.
What a way, like, wow, to commemorate her life and just the end, the closure,
right,
of all this.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Well, I can say wow, with certainty that you guys, you and the Mikes, are Sharon's heroes. She said that to me. I mean, you guys did so much for her and her family. And so, I mean, I thank you for the work that you put in just to bring justice to this case. And I know they, yeah, do. And they have been such an inspiration to me, her and Keith, just the way they would co-parent and, right, the way they stuck together even after they couldn't make it as a couple. I mean, they're great people. And I'll never forget this case. I know that.
You know, that's a huge statistic, and I don't know off the top of me what it is, but parents who lose a child to a crime like this generally don't make it.
Melissa was asking me last in the recording, and I didn't know the answer. Did Keith ever get his dad ring back, the one that was dad inscribed?
No, we never got the dad ring back. We never got the watch back. We got an Indian head ring, mm-hmm, and a couple of bracelets that I believe were Tara's brother's room.
Man. Because I know that ring meant the world to him, and I was hoping.
So Barr knew jewelry for sure. Like I said, he was a self-proclaimed expert, and he dealt with gold.
And
yeah, the other stuff was cosmetic jewelry, but the dad ring was gold ring, and I'm sure that got sold or melted or something.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I have a question. Is it true that you're a realtor? I was Googling.
So I have a really good friend that I met when we came here through my wife and his wife, and we do a lot of fishing together, and we've done some travel together. And a couple of years ago, right before COVID, he was asking about, could I come help him out? When was I ever going to retire? And I said, I don't think I can ever afford to retire. And he said, well, why don't you get your license and come help us out? And hopefully, you know, you can learn the business a little bit, and then, and then when you're ready, you can come in. And so I kind of do that full time. And this is a part time job here, although we work this kind of full time with, mm-hmm, a lot of time. So but I've learned the business, and I went in as never being involved in business in my life. And I thought it was of exploring it. It's challenging. It's something new, something I've never experienced, because I've been in law enforcement my whole life as an adult. But I also learned that there's a lot of stuff, the same kind of stuff in the criminal world that it goes in the business world. So I'll leave it at that. I thought it would be a little bit more pure, but it's not really. So
wild. Well, you're doing great. I mean, I like your posts. I think I was telling you this on the phone or via text. I think your presence is good. Like you're probably experiencing some of the same things that we are with this podcast, like trying to get our name out, trying to get our product out and our brand. And it's this social media world right now is so hard to navigate, and just, but I think your stuff's great. It looks fantastic.
Well, I'm not paying people to do that.
Right.
So I try to be real, and the number of emails I get from people that are trying to reach into my pocket to take care of all that. And the money, it's just ridiculous. And I'm doing it to make extra money. I'm not doing it to put a roof over my house.
Yes.
Or food in my mouth or my family. So it's kind of like to pay off debt and to build a cabin in our property up in Wisconsin.
And like really retire.
And maybe retire for a couple months a year or something. Yeah, maybe.
Good for you. Well, Kurt, seriously, thank you for all you do. Thank you for your service. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for what you've done for Tara's family.
Yes, thank you.
For the families that you have yet to bring justice for. So you're a good man, and I'm proud to know you, and I'm proud to call you a friend.
Well, I appreciate it, and I think you guys are doing a great job too. And like I said, you know, you are helping the victims if you're telling their story, and most of them want that to happen. So you are doing a service to these cases. So thank you.
Appreciate that, Kurt. All right, well, we'll talk really soon. All right, thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir. Anytime.
Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kurt is a cool dude, and I think that it would be really difficult to be that attached to. He was talking about how close he got with Sharon McPhillips over the course of this case. I imagine that adds a whole level of, I don't know, it makes it really, really personal and hard to forget.
I think it would be hard having kids like the same age. Like he kept talking about his, he said his daughters, and like mm-hmm. then I was thinking about Tara, and I was like, that can't be easy.
Right. I guess it's just one of the things that comes with being a police officer. It's just you're put in these situations and you don't know what that situation is going to be.
Yeah. You just have to do it.
Wild. Well, it was very insightful, and he offered some deeper dives into some of the stuff in Tara's case that we were like a little fuzzy on, or just things that we wanted to expand upon. But I mean, the work he does day in and day out, and the cases that he's helped solve, I know it means the world to these families. So, and I think if I were ever in law enforcement, that's the direction I would want to go, is to like cold case detective, like not grinding on the streets, like working these crazy cases, but like ones that just try to get them closed.
Yeah. Oh, it's like my dream, sit in the basement with a box of evidence. Just let me there. I'll be cases. Quiet. I will behave myself. Just do that all day.
I believe that. Well, that wraps up June for Murder Unscripted. So what do we got next month?
We have good things scheduled for July. We have a wild guest, which is going to be, you definitely don't want to miss it. Mm-hmm. And our theme is going to be girl power. And we are going to be covering just some like badass women in the criminal justice field, in the forensic field. I actually have one where like a family member solved a crime, like just all different things. And we're just going to celebrate because like this kind of is based off Colleen, because I'm so obsessed with her, the genetic genealogist. So we want to highlight other women like that.
So the guest is super cool. Like, we're really downplaying it, but pretty good guest.
It's big. Yeah. Well, next week I have a pretty awful case to tell you about. So it's going to be a rough one.
Great.
It may be a two-parter, guys. It's either going to be one really long episode or it might be a two-parter. I haven't decided yet.
You like don't know because I haven't written it yet.
Well, I have half of it written. I'm getting there. Yeah. I'm getting there. It
depends how much info you cram in.
Exactly. Well, you cool. don't want to miss it. If you have anything, any thoughts or any questions for Kurt, feel free to let us know and we'll pass them along.
Absolutely.
You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. You can hit us up on all of our socials at Murder Unscripted, or you can actually drop us a line through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
That's it.
Until next week, everyone, stay safe, be kind, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No, they do not. See ya.
Bye.